NATO wants to play hardball with Russia. Is that going to bring the war to an end? Is that going to cause Vladimir Putin to recalculate all of his calibrations of what's going to bring war or peace to an end, or that's going to help his country? It hasn't worked very well that way in the last, I don't know, 3.5 years. Maybe you can go all the way back to 2014. But somehow some members of NATO think it's going to help this time. And we're going to try and talk about this and a lot of other things, especially with what's going on in the Middle East today. A lot of hot topics on that, too. We have the ever popular John Mearsheimer, international relations theorist, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. John, welcome back to the show, as always.
As always, glad to be here, Danny.
And it is a great, we're really excited to have you on today. A lot of things going on. We're going to start with what's going on in the Russia-Ukraine war, though, because there's been lots of talk, especially here of late, about the Tomahawk missiles and whether they should be sent to Ukraine or not. Volodymyr Zelensky, about a week or 10 days ago, specifically asked for them. Vice President J.D. Vance confirmed that, yes, that request has come up. It did come to President Trump. He is considering it. And then Trump himself put a little fuel into that fire and said, well, I've kind of made my decision in the Oval Office just this past week, but I'm want to see first where they want to use them first, et cetera. Well, that's not apparently enough for the for some in Estonia, because the Estonian foreign minister has said that he told ABC News in an interview yesterday, I'm sorry, 2 days ago, that Trump supplying those cruise missiles would send a very strong message to Moscow. Whatever we can give, he said, without any restrictions to Ukraine, is helping to win the war and push Russia back, the foreign minister said. So if President Trump and the U.S. is deciding to take down restrictions for military support as well as Tomahawks, it's just helping Ukraine to win and push back Russia. What say you, Professor Mearsheimer?
I'd say that that individual is delusional. First of all, this is not NATO wanting to push back. This is the Europeans wanting to push back. It's quite clear that Trump doesn't want to push back and that Trump is trying to distance himself from this conflict. And that's why he's been hemming and hawing on the whole Tomahawk issue. But it's the Europeans who want to get tough with the Russians. But the question is, how are they going to get tough with the Russians? You know, there's all this talk about sanctions, but nobody's really seriously pushing that option anymore. There's sometimes talk about sending NATO troops into Ukraine, but that's not going to happen. And I think there are limits to how much weaponry that NATO is going to be able to provide Ukraine moving forward. When you look at the health of the European economies and you look at the fact that Trump is not interested in giving weapons to Ukraine directly and wants the Europeans to buy those weapons from the United States and then give them to Ukraine, it seems to me that this all adds up to a situation where the number of weapons going into Ukraine is going to decrease over time. And further disadvantage them on the battlefield. So then it appears that Tomahawk missiles are the magic weapon. I don't think that Trump is going to give the Europeans, or let me put it differently. I don't think Trump is going to allow the Europeans to buy Tomahawks to give to the Ukrainians. And if that does happen, I don't believe Trump will give the Ukrainians permission to use large numbers of those Tomahawks against Russia. So the idea that these are war-winning weapons is just not a serious argument. So what we have here is the Europeans talking tough, but carrying a little stick.
Yeah, that's not supposed to be the way it's supposed to work. But, you know, interestingly enough, that there's more and more talk, I think, about getting tough with Russia, and no consideration to what the reaction of all of this tough talk is going to be. We had Ursula von der Leyen just a couple of days ago at the European Commission made a speech and said that basically we need to recognize we are in a cyber war with Russia. And then here recently we had Chancellor Friedrich Merz from Germany saying that we're not at war with Russia, but he said
drone flights, espionage, the Tiergarten murder, massive threats to individual public figures, not only in Germany but also in many other European countries. Acts of sabotage on a daily basis. Attempts to paralyze data centers. Cyber attacks. I suspect that here in the room, probably every second person has already been affected by how their data networks and infrastructure have been attacked. We are not at war, but we are no longer at peace, and we must be clear about this if we want to meet the challenges we are now facing.
See, and it's unclear, and he didn't specify, we have to be clear on the not at war, but not at peace situation, and we need to take actions. I'm not sure what actions he's talking about, but the gist is, and by the way, in concert with Ursula von der Leyen's comments here, they are reinforcing and doubling down on their comment that they want to have a big rebuild program within the European Union. And by 2029, they want to be pressing towards, an $800 billion advance. They want to have all these military capabilities, et cetera. Where do you see this going, and what reaction do you expect it to have on the Russian side?
Well, first of all, the charge that the Russians are sort of provoking the Europeans and taking all these actions that are designed to cause trouble for the West are really, for the most part, unproven. You know, there was talk for a while that the Russians were responsible for forcing Ursula von der Leyen's plane to stay in the air over Bulgaria because they were jamming the navigation system. And then, fortunately, she barely got down on the ground safely. It's now been shown that this is simply not true. It was a ludicrous charge. The Russians weren't jamming the navigation system on von der Leyen's plane. And then with regard to this argument that the Russians overflew Estonian territory, the Russians deny it, and it appears that if anything, they overflew a rock that is in the Baltic Sea. The idea that this was some sort of purposeful major provocation doesn't measure up at all. Then there was talk that the Russians were flying drones over airports in Copenhagen and Oslo. That didn't prove to be true either. And then there's the charge that the Russians launched all those drones into Poland. And the Russians do not deny that in all likelihood, some Russian drones wandered into Poland. These were not armed drones, but nevertheless, probably Russian drones. And what was the Russian response? Let's have an investigation to see exactly what happened so that it doesn't happen again. What was NATO's response? We don't want to have an investigation. And of course, they don't want to have an investigation because they'll find out that the Russians were not purposely trying to provoke NATO. So this whole idea that the Russians are picking a fight with NATO is not supported by the evidence. And I think what's going on here is that it's NATO that wants to pick a fight with the Russians. And the reason is that the Russians are winning on the battlefield. The Europeans are desperate, and they're doing everything they can to ginny up public support and to ginny up support in the United States, especially with President Trump, to get tough with the Russians. That's what's going on here. But the problem is, even if you want to get tough with the Russians, this gets back to our earlier conversation, what are you going to do? There's just no option here. The West is out of bullets. Sending Tomahawks is not going to solve the problem any more than sending ATACMs way back when solved the problem. Or before that, sending HIMARS solved the problem. There's no magic bullet. The Russians are going to win. This is going to be a humiliating defeat for NATO. It's going to be a humiliating defeat for these NATO or European leaders who we see paraded about every day. And they don't want that to happen. So they're desperate. And this is what we get, but it just doesn't add up to much.
So let me ask your opinion here. One of the things, there's a couple of things that are feeding into some of this increasing, in my view, boisterous talk from a number of European partners. And I think it's two parts, and I'd like your answer or discussion on both. The first one is that they see this rebuild and rearm Europe program. And they say that by 2029, they will have $800 billion invested, that they will be producing a lot more, that their industrial capacity will be larger, et cetera. First of all, let me ask, do you think that that is an achievable goal, that by 2029, so 4 years from now, basically by the start of 2030, that Europe will be in a place where it could actually fight and sustain a war with Russia if it came to it?
I don't think so. I think if you look at the state of the economies in places like Britain, France, and Germany, the biggest three economies in Europe, they are in deep trouble. And these are countries that are committed to significant amounts of welfare spending. And the idea that you're going to stop spending on welfare, especially given these hard economic times, and you're going to take that money and you're going to spend it on the military to deal with what is, Danny, largely an imaginary threat. I mean, the idea that Russia has this powerful army that is poised to move into Eastern Europe and then into Central Europe and maybe even Western Europe, that it has the capability to do that. And moreover, its leaders have the intention to do that is simply not true. It's a ludicrous argument. We've watched the Russian army struggle since 2022 to conquer the eastern one-fifth of Ukraine. Does this look like an army that has the capability to conquer all of Ukraine?
Right. That's actually the second part of what I want to talk about in a second, because I've got an interesting observation from someone who was on our show yesterday. But before I get that, in sticking with this first here, this 4 year period here, and whether or not they can actually physically accomplish that, to what extent, from your observations here, are shifting domestic political winds blowing in various European countries? I mean, we already have Slovakia and Hungary are definitely not for any kind of a war with Russia. They want to get back to normalizations. But now then here we have Czech Republic just had an election, and they're now moving more in a direction towards accommodation and definitely not towards antagonism toward Russia. To what extent do you see that happen with any of the other countries, and can they maintain the cohesion that relatively they have now to even keep going down this path to where people would be willing to have their funds diverted from any kind of social programs to ramping up and getting ready for a war with Russia?
Well, it's very hard to tell exactly what's going to happen in any one of these countries. But if you take France, it's hard to believe that Macron is going to survive. And if a government of the left or a government of the right comes in, there's almost no question that that government, be it left or right, will be less enthusiastic about supporting Ukraine than the Macron government is. Then there's the simple question of whether any government in France can continue to support Ukraine in ways that keeps it afloat in this fight with the Russians. You want to remember that even when the United States was in the fight under Joe Biden, the Russians were still winning and Ukraine was losing. Well, now we're in a situation where you're taking the Americans largely out of the equation. So the question is, can the Europeans up the ante? We're not just talking about continuing what they've been doing since 2022. We're talking about upping the ante to compensate for what is going to be missing because the United States is in good part walking away. And I think that means the strains on the economies in Germany, France, and Britain will be greater than ever. And this is all at a time when those economies are crumbling, maybe too strong a word, but are in deep
struggling.
Yeah, struggling. So I think even if Macron were able to stay in power, there'd be limits to what he could do. I'd be shocked if, over the next, let's say, 5 years, that Germany builds a really powerful army that's capable of going head to head with the Russians. But furthermore, it's not going to have to go head to head with the Russians because the Russians are not interested in going head to head with the German army.
Now, the second half of the reason why I think you see it a lot, at least some in Europe, want to get a little bit more feisty with Russia is because what you mentioned a second ago. They look at that and they see, you may recall Macron about a month or so ago mocked the Russians, said, you know, you've only taken 1% of the territory in the last 2 years. Yeah, you've caused a lot of Ukrainian casualties, but still, that's as far as you've been able to get there. And the idea is that they've only gone that much because that's all they can do. Well, there is a growing number of complaints inside of Russia, ironically, that are pro on the Putin side that are starting to get more aggravated at Putin because of his go slow process and his risk averse actions on the front line, which gives motivation to the European side to get some confidence from it. Whereas they say, if you press the metal to, or the pedal to the metal, you could win this in a lot faster. Here is Gilbert Doctorow yesterday on our show making a pretty interesting claim.
You have to go out 4 years. This bridging loan, which the Europeans want to give to Ukraine, is to keep the Ukrainians in play for 3 years, for 4 years. They are spending now hundreds of billions of euros to build up Europe's military production. Germany is a leader in this with a 1 trillion euro debt that's taking out mostly for the purpose of building out its armed forces and for, as Mr. Metz said openly, to make Germany the biggest defender, he calls it, in Western Europe. That will be ready for 2029. Merz has said the Russians will attack in 2029. He means that he will attack Russia in 2029. And if he builds out the army as he plans, the Europe could just win. This is not my opinion. Experts on Russian state television are saying that German industry should not be disparaged. The situation that Europe is looking at is a 4-year perspective.
So what do you make of that? And by the way, he also in that same interview said that he thinks that from the Russian state television and from other people that he talks to on the Russian side, that they say that you could come close to winning this war in a big fait accompli if you would use your arrest sticks and decapitate the government, the leaders, et cetera, with no one could, you know, help out from all that. What do you make of this claim that he thinks that it's actually the Europeans who want to go to war with Russia by 2029?
Well, the two issues here, does the German buildup or the European buildup affect events in Ukraine? That's one issue. And then the question you were asking is, did the Germans or the Europeans want to go to war against Russia? So let's take those questions in reverse order. I find it hard to imagine that anyone would seriously argue that Germany is going to build its army up to the point where it can start World War III with Russia. I mean, is this really a serious argument? Why would they do that? The Russians are interested in conquering the eastern portion of Ukraine, maybe 20-25%, maybe 30-35%. Who knows for sure how much they'll end up with? But they're not going to conquer all of Ukraine, right? And the Russians are not going to be looking for a fight. So why would the Germans start a fight with the Russians? This just makes no sense at all. We're talking about a country that has nuclear weapons, lots of nuclear weapons. We're talking about a country that has probably the most formidable conventional army on the planet at this point in time. The Russians have been at war since 2022. According to my calculations, that's over 3.5 years. That army has improved significantly over time. Do the Germans really want to put together an army and march on Moscow? I think it's a ludicrous argument. So the Germans, even if they build up this army, which I have doubts about, are not going to pick a fight with the Russians, and the Russians are not going to pick a fight with them. So this is not going to happen. Then the question is, if the Germans get really serious about building up the defense capabilities, is this going to have any effect on the war in Ukraine? And the answer is no. What the Ukrainians need are troops. They need soldiers. They're running out of people up on the front lines. They need weaponry. They need more artillery. They need more drones. They need glide bombs of their own. They need an air force. They need Patriot missiles. Can the West provide manpower for them? No, not at all. Can it provide a sufficient amount of weaponry to allow them to stop the Russians? No. I mean, we've watched what's happened even when the Americans were in the fight. And as I was saying before, the Americans are not in the fight. So you can have a German buildup, and it's just not going to matter.
Yeah, I can't argue with any of your calculations. And by the way, I think I can validate that your calculations are correct on that. And the idea that in only 4 years hence that suddenly there's going to be this Wehrmacht-like Russian or German army that could actually pose a threat, I think is not very serious. But listen, I want to shift because we got a lot of other things to talk about here today. I want to shift over to the news that's really breaking, even as we're probably still talking on the air here, and that is the possibility that the war between Israel and Hamas might be over. We'll wait and see what comes out of the Israeli cabinet. One of the Trump has, of course, announced that there's a ceasefire and that an agreement by both Hamas and the Israeli side in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. He has said the hostages are going to be released on Monday, and everything comes down to if the Israeli cabinet agrees to it. Earlier information that I saw today said that the Israeli cabinet had the numbers, even though they have opposition from Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and a lot of their allies, but it's not enough. So Netanyahu is probably going to get that. But part of the potential sticking point is that Hamas has said that they will agree to it so long as the Israeli cabinet has a declaration that the war will be over, not merely a ceasefire. What are your expectations and observations even at this early stage so far?
Well, the reports are that for there to be a deal, for Trump to get the deal that he's been working on, there has to be a prisoner or hostage exchange. And that seems like the easiest part of the deal. And then the Israelis have to pull out of a substantial number of places in Gaza. They have to pull out of Gaza City, which they've been attacking recently. They have to pull out of Rafah. And Khan Yunis as well. And that's significant to get the Israelis.
Yeah, you can put up that yellow line map while he's talking. That'd be great.
And furthermore, I don't see the cities.
It's hard to see. This is the map released by actually Trump, where Khan Yunis is in the south there inside that yellow line, which is where Israel says they'll make an initial withdrawal to.
Yeah, so they have to pull out of Khan Yunis, Rafah, and they have to pull out of Gaza City. And furthermore, they have to open up five different points where humanitarian aid, which is managed not by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, but by international organizations, will be allowed to bring, you know, food, medicine, and water through those points. And it appears that that Trump has set this up so that declarations are going to be made by him that this is the end and that the ceasefire is going to stick. As long as the Palestinians or as long as Hamas sticks to the deal will remain in place and Israel will be in no position, so the agreement says, to violate the ceasefire and go back to the genocide. I think if this actually happens, it'll be a wonderful development in the sense that it will end all of the murder and mayhem that the Israelis have been creating in Gaza. But the truth is, Danny, it's just one step in the right direction in no way, shape, or form. You know, is this a meaningful settlement to the problem between Israel and the Palestinians?
Now, there was an interview this morning on Fox News with the Israeli foreign minister, Saar, who was asked a number of key questions in relation to the Trump plan and what Israel's going to do. And on the issue, the first one I want to talk about is he was asked point blank, is this the end of the war?
Is this the end of the war?
Well, it's the implementation of the first phase. We don't have any intention to renew the war. but parts of the commitments is, for example, the disarmament of Hamas, that they will lay down their arms and so on.
And that will be phase two.
We will first have a ceasefire immediately after the decision will be approved by the government. There will be a ceasefire.
So if you're on the Palestinian side, you certainly are glad to hear any of that. Anything that stops the bombs is, as you say, a great first step. The foreign minister there actually said the same thing you did. Well, this is step one in the right direction. We can go on that. But they probably also remember just earlier this very year, there was another ceasefire that was supposed to result in the end of the war. But that didn't work out very well. And the Israeli side really seemed to really chop the feet out from underneath that one. And it went back into conflict. What risk do you think that there is that this one sticks, either doesn't do that or does stick? What do you think?
Well, you want to remember the Israelis are not interested in these negotiations. They've been pushed into a situation where they just don't have much choice to go along with the plan that Trump has been pushing forward at this juncture. But remember, the Israelis tried to kill the Hamas negotiators in Doha. They tried to kill the negotiators. If you're interested in negotiating a settlement like this, you don't try to kill the negotiators. Furthermore, the Israelis' principal goal here is to ethnically cleanse Gaza. And the genocide is the instrument that they use for that purpose. They're murdering huge numbers of Palestinians simply because they want to drive them out of Gaza. And if they can't drive them out of Gaza, they want to kill all of them. I don't believe their goal has changed. I believe they've been unsuccessful. This has been going on for 2 years, and they're finding it increasingly difficult, they meaning the Israelis, to continue the genocide. So you have this pause now, but I think they will be looking for opportunities to break the ceasefire. And this, of course, is why Hamas is insisting that the Israelis have to say, this is the end of the war, right? This is the end, because the Palestinians fear greatly that what the Israelis will do is what they did earlier this year when they violated the ceasefire, as you described.
That's one of the things that the Palestinians are going to be looking for, and one of the things that I worry about. But as you say, there is a difference between this time and in January, where there's a lot more international pressure on Israel and pressure from within the United States, actually, as well. That's different than then. So maybe we'll get that this time. One of the next things, one of the second or third steps, is going to be the withdrawal of the Israeli forces. That's one of the things that's in President Trump's plan. So that was the next thing that Fox asked the foreign minister about.
When do you expect to completely pull out of Gaza?
We are committed to Trump's plan. The first withdrawal or redeployment will happen immediately in order to make the first phase happen. And we will do that immediately after the decision of the government within 24 hours. With regard to other parts, they are conditional. There are parts that Hamas must do. It's not that only Israel should implement. Israel should do things, but there are parts Hamas must do. Hamas must disarm. We should dismantle Gaza Strip. We should implement all parts of Trump's plan.
So I'm going to circle back again to his comment there. He keeps saying that we want to implement Trump's plan. So remember that for a second. But look at this first one here. Now, that map Gary showed you a second ago, apparently from what I'm hearing from Israeli media this morning, is that they're saying their initial withdrawal plan will only be to this area where it says yellow. In this particular map here, the yellow is where the Israelis will remain, and the blank areas along the coast is where they're pulled out of. So it's only 58% of the strip, or it's full 58% that they'll retain. And then there's no promise or no timeline for when they would fully withdraw. What do you see any potential problems with that?
Of course. But just to be clear here, the ultimate goal of the plan was to have a full withdrawal with one major caveat. And that major caveat is that the Israelis would control the entire perimeter of Gaza, to include the border between Gaza and Egypt. So in the plan, the 20-point plan that President Trump put out, Israel would get out of all those yellow areas except for the borders of Gaza. And I think what you see on that map is pretty much in keeping with the Trump plan. The Trump plan called for a phased withdrawal, and this is phase one. So this is not surprising at all, except for the fact that it's surprising that the Israelis pulled out of those three big cities that we were talking about before, that they agreed to do that, but they obviously felt that they had no choice. Now, whether they pull out of those yellow areas and where this all goes remains to be seen. As I said to you before, it's just very important to understand that that Israel is committed to ethnically cleansing all of Gaza. They want to drive all the Palestinians out. And if you have any sort of meaningful ceasefire now that holds and the war or the genocide goes away, the Israelis have not achieved their principal goal. And I actually believe, Danny, when the Israelis, when the shooting finally stops here and the Israelis take stock of what's happened over the past 2 years, it's going to be seen as a total disaster. You know, the Israelis, and of course their supporters here in the United States, which includes almost everybody in the mainstream media, are constantly spinning this story about what a great strategic situation the Israelis are in today, about all these victories they've won and so forth and so on. As I just pointed out, they've not won in Gaza. Hamas is not defeated. Hezbollah has not been defeated. And furthermore, with regard to Iran, there's all this talk about this great victory in June. Well, if they scored a great victory in June, why are they talking about attacking again this fall? They're talking about attacking again this fall because they didn't score a great victory. They didn't destroy the nuclear enrichment capability of Iran. And furthermore, they didn't break Iran up into little pieces. They didn't do to Iran what they did to Syria. And that's what they want to do. So they want to go back at Iran. So I think if you sort of look at what's happened to Israel, and then you throw in the damage, the permanent damage that's been done to Israel's reputation because of the genocide, I think these past 2 years are going to be seen as a disaster for Israel, a terrible situation. So all of this is to say they have a vested interest, the leaders do, in continuing the war so that they can drive all the Palestinians out and say, look, we achieved this great victory.
Yeah, well, we'll certainly see how that's going to work out. That would not suit well with President Trump, who tomorrow there's going to be an announcement of the Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, he's been lobbying pretty hard for that. And at least part of me thinks that there's probably a good bit of reason to suspect that Trump was pushing to get this done now ahead of the announcement of that to try to increase the chances that he gets it. But hey, whatever motivates him to get this war over and the killing stopped, at least anything, one day of having the killing stopped is better than the none that we've had over the last two, mostly over the last 2 years. So I'm at least have an outside hope that this turns into something sustained. But there's a real problem with it, because I heard Foreign Minister Saar there continually mention Trump's plan. We want to implement Trump's plan. Well, there's some problems with that. And I'm going to pull up this version of it here. This is on the NBC News here, where they published the text of the full plan. I'm just going to go over a couple of the issues, which I think maybe some of the more problematic ones. Number six here is the first one that I want to look at here. It says all hostages are returned. Hamas members who commit to peaceful coexistence and decommissioning their weapons will be given amnesty. Members of Hamas who wish to leave Gaza will be provided safe passage to receiving countries. So my first question to you is, it's like a potential bitter pill here and a problem for many in Israel. Because if you hold that Hamas was responsible for starting this war and that they can't govern Gaza, that's fair enough. But if they were able to remain and they're given amnesty or that they're allowed out, what's to prevent them from, you know, getting ready for the next phase somewhere else and having terrorist attacks? I mean, that seems like that would be a problem for Israel.
It is a problem, and there's no solution to that problem other than giving the Palestinians a sovereign state or control over their own fate. And the Israelis are unwilling to do that. So the problem just doesn't go away. There's just no solution to it. And the Israelis understand that, and that's why they want to ethnically cleanse Gaza. They just want to get rid of all the Palestinians.
Gary, if you can roll up there, the other one I want to look at here is roll all the way down to the bottom. We'll skip some of the other stuff I was going to look at. And that's number 19. Number 19 says, while Gaza redevelopment advances and when the Palestinian Authority reform program is faithfully carried out, the conditions may finally be in place for a credible pathway to a Palestinian self-determination and statehood, which we recognize as the aspiration of the Palestinian people. So President Trump's plan says we need at least a credible pathway to self-determination. At that same meeting this morning on Fox News, the foreign minister was directly asked that question too.
When do you expect to completely pull out of Gaza?
We are committed to Trump's plan. The first withdrawal or redeployment will happen immediately in order to make the first phase happen. And we will do that immediately after the decision of the government within 24 hours. With regard to other parts, there are conditional. There are parts that Hamas must do. It's not that only Israel should implement. Israel should do things, but there are parts Hamas must do. Hamas must disarm. We should dismantle Gaza Strip. We should implement all parts of Trump's plan.
I'm sorry, Gary, I threw a curveball at you there. That's my fault. I'm actually looking for the one called Israel.
Will the government of Israel now accept a Palestinian state? Is this a step towards statehood?
No, I think that one should read President Trump's plan. President Trump's plan saying that the PA should work and really reform, and it refers to the previous Trump plan of 2020, and you should read that also. You have there the stop of the pay for slay, stop incitement in education system of the Palestinian Authority, recognition in Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, withdrawing from the claim to right of return to all of Israel. So if you take it by the words, I want to see the PA implementing in order that they will be able to be a reliable partner.
So that wasn't the question that was asked. It was, will you agree to a Palestinian state? And we have to remember that right before all this stuff at the UN General Assembly, Benjamin Netanyahu pounded on the desk and said, absolutely not. It would be a reward for 10-7. We won't do it. After the meeting with Trump, where he agreed to this in principle, he said in Hebrew that absolutely not. There's no way they're going to do that. And even here, you see the foreign minister saying no. The issue of whether there is even a pathway to a Palestinian state is absolutely essential to the Palestinian people and having any reason to live in peace. And then, of course, you have 156 nations have, at least on paper, recognized the presence of a Palestinian state. What do you read about that? And especially if Israel never does that, what is that going to mean for peace?
But Danny, I think that you're not reading point number 19 of the 20 points clearly. And you got to read 19 clearly and look at point number 20. Point number 19 does not say that the United States is committed to a Palestinian state. The language is conditional and it focuses on what is a Palestinian aspiration. Point 20 is the key point, and it says that there is no political horizon established. And what we have to do is have dialogue to figure out what the political horizon is. The political horizon is the end game. It's what the final political solution is. And the document says that we have no final solution here. There's no Palestinian state as the ultimate goal. And you want to understand that the Israelis went over these 20 points with a fine-tooth comb. Ron Derner, who is Netanyahu's principal advisor on these matters, met twice on the Thursday before the Monday and on the Sunday before the Monday when Trump issued this plan. And they carefully crafted the language to make sure it doesn't reflect the argument that we're going to end up with a Palestinian state. This plan that you're looking at is not simply Donald Trump's plan. It's an Israeli-American plan. And there's no language in there that can be read to say that you're going to end up with a Palestinian state. And of course, when you listen to the Israelis talk, there's no way there's going to be a Palestinian state. I mean, look, what's happening here? We're talking about a Palestinian state. We're talking about a country where that's run by genocidal monsters who've been conducting a genocide for 2 years and whose principal goal is to drive the Palestinians out of Gaza. They don't want a two-state solution. They want a greater Israel that has no Palestinians in its midst. And the idea that, you know, Trump is going to get a two-state solution is delusional.
So do you think that it's, because it does say that, you know, a valid pathway to that two states, to a Palestinian state, is that just to sop to all those 156 countries out there, or to give political cover that, hey, well, we're trying, even though in practice, because of point number 20, there's basically no chance that it will ever exist.
But read what it says in 19 again. Just read it. I can't see very clearly.
Okay. Yeah, it says, while Gaza redevelopment advances and when the PA reform program is faithfully carried out, the conditions may finally be in place.
May, did you hear that word? May.
Yes, the conditions may finally be in place for a credible pathway to Palestinian self-determination and statehood. So there's words in there that somebody who wants a two-state solution will see that. And then there's also the words that you pointed out that may finally be, that give an out to not accomplishing it.
Yeah, I mean,
my question is, is this just a sop to the people who want to focus on the word statehood and say, yeah, that's where it's going, and they can believe it because they want to and not pay attention to the other words?
Yes, exactly. That's what it is. This is carefully crafted language, right? But the fact is, the Israelis have made it unequivocally clear that there's not going to be a Palestinian state. And when you look at public opinion polls inside of Israel, there's no interest in giving the Palestinians a state. And after what's happened over the past 2 years, do you really think that you could create a two-state solution at this juncture? I don't think so. I mean, the level of hatred and distrust on both sides is just enormous. And again, if you go to the 20th point where they talk about what is the political horizon, I mean, just, we should read point number 20.
Yeah, the United States will establish a dialogue between Israel and the Palestinians to agree on a political horizon for peaceful and prosperous coexistence.
Right. Why are they establishing a dialogue? Because the two sides don't agree. Do you think they're going to have a meaningful dialogue? Right. The Israelis have never agreed in any meaningful way to a two-state solution. They were, you know, coming closer and closer to that in the 1990s. But by the time the Camp David negotiations ended in 2000, it was all over with for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, and especially because Netanyahu's been in charge for much of that time in between. He has been staunchly against it. So real quick, before we pivot over to one more topic here, what then does that mean long term for this? If the Palestinians' aspirations are never going to be met, what's going to happen after this, when this war comes to an end?
More horrible things are going to happen to the Palestinians. Just look at what's happening on the West Bank. I mean, we're talking about Gaza, right? There were 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza before the genocide started. And at the same time, there were 3.2 million Palestinians in the West Bank. Look at what they're doing on the West Bank. It's horrendous, right? They're trying to ethnically cleanse the West Bank as well. They want to drive the 3.2 million Palestinians on the West Bank out every bit as much as they want to drive the Palestinians in Gaza out. they want a greater Israel that's Palestinian free. That's what's going on here. And they're willing to create or execute a genocide in Gaza to achieve this. Just look at that footage. Look at what they've done in Gaza. It's just truly remarkable.
In the worst way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it violates everything we're supposed to stand for as a liberal democracy. And again, as I said before, the monsters who executed this genocide are still in power.
Right. And unfortunately, that may not be the end of the target list. I want to, in the remainder of the time that we have here, I want to pivot to one of the other things that Trump's actually said on a Fox News last night. One of the things that he says helped come to get this agreement was the attack against Iran back in June.
So Gaza, we believe, is going to be a much safer place, and it's going to be a place that reconstructs, and other countries in the area will help it reconstruct because they have tremendous amounts of wealth, and they want to see that happen. And we'll be involved in helping them make it successful and helping it stay peaceful. But I think it's going to be peaceful. I think, again, the Iran situation was very important doing what we had to do, which was, again, 22 years it was planned to be done, and no other president wanted to do it or whatever, for whatever reason, but they didn't do it. And having that was very important.
What do you make of Trump making a point of saying out loud that the attack on Iran that the United States led and that Israel participated in was responsible for achieving this milestone here?
Well, let me make one other point before I answer that question. If you listen to President Trump, not just in that announcement, but in a number of other things he said in recent days, he is really committing himself publicly to peace in Gaza. It's not going to be easy for the Israelis to get around that and to restart the genocide. I'm not saying they can't do it. I'd never underestimate the Israelis' ability to manipulate Trump. But Trump is really publicly committed to peace in Gaza. And I think the Palestinians, and here we're talking about Hamas mainly, I think they've figured out that they have to hitch their wagon to Trump and hope that Trump can sort of lead them out of the wilderness. So it'd be very interesting to see how this plays out, because Trump, again, is publicly committed to creating peace in Gaza. With regard to Iran, the logic that explains how Iran led to this agreement in Gaza escapes me. Do you understand what it is?
I don't. And there was no explicit connection made other than just the claim of it. He had another, which I'll get into here, but he also made a claim that tariffs were apparently instrumental in getting the message across to some. I'm not sure how that worked out other than to say he wants to validate the things that he's been doing and say, here's some production. But he also brought up Iran this morning at a cabinet meeting he had. He was asked about Iran, and here's what he had to say then.
Iran wants to work on peace now. They've informed us, and they've acknowledged that they are totally in favor of this deal. They think it's a great thing. So we appreciate that. And we'll work with Iran. As you know, we have major sanctions on Iran and lots of other things. We'd like to see them be able to rebuild their country, too. But they can't have a nuclear weapon.
So he keeps going back to that they can't have a nuclear weapon. Well, there's lots of news out here right now that Iran is strongly rebuilding its air defenses and continuing to advance its missile production. There are those in Israel who are warning this. This party chairman, Avigdor Lieberman, on yesterday, doubled down on his controversial warning of a potential Iranian attack, telling national broadcaster Khan that the Iranians are determined to take revenge and that the people should remain in close proximity to protected spaces. We are certain that regardless of the negotiations over both the Iranian nuclear deal, and apparently he may also have in mind this stuff with the Hamas, the Iranians are determined to take revenge. What do you make of that?
I see no evidence of that. And from a commonsensical point of view, I can't imagine the Iranians attacking Israel and or the United States. It would just make no sense at all. As I've watched the Iranians over the past few years, they're doing everything they can to avoid a conflict with Israel and the United States. It's the Israelis who are in the driver's seat when it comes to causing war between Iran and Israel, or Iran on one side and Israel and the United States on the other. I don't know what Lieberman is talking about. I would note, though, President Trump's comments are very interesting. And I say that because I think when you look carefully at the balance of power between Israel on one side and Iran on the other, the idea that Israel can just go in there and slam Iran and win another great victory is not in line with facts and logic. I think in terms of the first war, and here we're talking about the 12-day war in June, even though the United States participated for one day, that was on June 22nd, as you remember, I don't think Israel won a victory in that war. As I said before, they did not destroy the nuclear enrichment capability of Iran. Iran is rebuilding, and it's going to have a nuclear enrichment capability for as far as the eye can see. They didn't decapitate the regime. They didn't break the country up into parts. And if anything, they caused more cohesion between the government and the people than existed before the attack started on June 13th. So they failed. And furthermore, as you well know, Danny, the Iranian ballistic missiles and cruise missiles really began to have an effect on Israel. They were hammering Israel when the conflict ended. And there's all sorts of evidence that the Israelis asked Trump to shut the war down because the Israelis were running out of defensive missiles.
Right. And one of the key statistics that came out toward the end of that was the revelation that the Iranians started learning as the war went on and how to make the attacks, and the percentage of missiles getting through was increasing on the Iranian side. And I think that's what led Israel to say, oh, smokes, we need to get this shut off.
Yeah, well, as you know better than I do, militaries learn in the conduct of a war. You've seen this with the Russians and with the Ukrainians as well. You get quite sophisticated because your life is on the line. So the Iranians got smarter, as you would expect. And the second point I would make is when I was, you know, in the Air Force, I worked in research and development and worked for a period on ballistic missiles, things like Minuteman and MX. And my sense is that attacking missiles always defeat defending missiles. That the idea that you can build up a successful missile defense is a pipe dream. It may work somewhat in the beginning, but eventually the offender overwhelms the defender. There are just so many ways. When people talk about the United States building ballistic missile defenses against Russia, I think if I'm a Russian, I want to encourage them to build a big missile defense system, spend as much money on that system as possible, because it'll be throwing money down a rat hole, because I can easily build the ballistic missile force, especially with a lot of decoys that can just overwhelm that system. So I think the problem that the Israelis face is that they cannot procure a missile defense system that would allow them to prevail in a war in which the Iranians were throwing large numbers of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and drones at them. And I think that's what you saw in the 12-day war. At first, the Israelis did quite well, but then the Iranians learned, and then the Israelis began to run out of defensive missiles. This is what happens. And by the way, those defensive missiles are incredibly expensive. And you can build decoys very cheaply, which cause all sorts of problems for the defenses. So all this is to say, I'm not sure the Israelis are going to attack Iran in the fall. If I had to bet, I would bet they will.
So despite any kind of evidence or any kind of rational, they still might do it anyway. But yeah. Well, that leads me into the second part of that question is, from a I don't know if psychological is the right word, but from a political perspective, they have painted Iran as this, you know, the head of the octopus and these tentacles and all this. You mentioned earlier that they will have to view, if they're being honest anyway, everything that's happened in the last 2 years in terms of Hamas as a disaster for Israel. They didn't accomplish hardly any of their objectives at all, and they've now created new negatives that they didn't have before. But then you look at the situation with Iran. Now that we see that Israel's more vulnerable to missile attack, and they can't defend against that, but they have set that up as the quin sanon, so to speak, that, you know, that's what it's all about, getting Iran. And can they just go, okay, all right, forget it, we'll just live with Iran now? Do you see that happening?
No. And by the way, the issue here, despite all this talk about Iran racing to get a bomb, that was not the issue. The problem was that Iran had a significant nuclear enrichment capability. You remember, they were enriching up to 60%, not far away from 90%. And in fact, it's a hop, skip, and a jump from 60% to 90%. That spooked the Israelis. The Israelis wanted to do away with their enrichment capability. The argument for not attacking Iran was that you had IAEA inspectors in there, and we could keep an eye on what the Iranians were doing. There are no more IAEA inspectors in there as a result of the 12-day war and what the Europeans and the Americans have done since the 12-day war. So we're now in a situation where we're blind as to what Iran is actually doing on the nuclear front. And from Israel's point of view, this is a disaster. Furthermore, almost everybody agrees that the 12-day war gave the Iranians a greater incentive to acquire a nuclear deterrent. That's not to say they will acquire a nuclear deterrent, but the war gave them a greater incentive to acquire one. You don't have your eyes anymore to see what they're doing because the IAEA is no longer there. So they're much worse off vis-a-vis Iran than they were before October 12th. And by the way, Hezbollah and Hamas are both alive. They inflicted limited defeats on both of them, but they're both alive. And as I like to say, when people say, well, they were decapitated. Yeah, they were decapitated, but then they grew back new heads.
Right. So,
and then you could decapitate them again and they'll grow back new heads. And the same thing is true with Iran. So that doesn't buy you anything. And furthermore, and this is terribly important in my opinion, the Israelis are more dependent on the Americans than they have ever been. There was a recent report that was just issued that says that we, the Americans, have given the Israelis over $31 billion, $31 billion in assistance since October 7th, 2023, over the past 2 years, $31 billion. This is truly stunning. By the way, approximately 21 billion was in direct economic and military assistance. And the other 10 was the money that we spent, fighting wars on Israel's behalf. Just amazing amount of money. And as you know, you and I have talked about this on many occasions. There's no way they could have executed this genocide. And gone around the Middle East bombing every country in sight without American assistance. They just absolutely need us.
Yeah, and then the question is, you know, what's going to happen after this? Because as you said, Trump has put his credibility. I mean, he really wants, especially if he gets that Nobel Peace Prize tomorrow. We'll see if that happens. I'm seeing some of our commentators here in our group that's watching there. A lot of them will be rolling their eyes or dying if he gets it, but he may. But he's invested himself in this. And if Israel, whether that's, you know, in the fall, that they try anything against Iran or if they go back into the Gaza Strip, it's just going to be harder because there's already a lot of antagonism around the world against Israel, much higher than it was 2 years ago. And it's probably going to be placated some by if this ceasefire sticks. But if you then flame that back up, I think that the antagonism could go higher on the post side of that. So there's some real risk, I think, for Israel.
Yeah. I think, by the way, just with regard to Trump, I think he is getting, Well, let me make 2 points. One is just on the Nobel Prize. I do not think he'll get the Nobel Prize tomorrow simply because the decision was made on who would get the prize before these new events in Gaza. And I think if anything, he will aim to get the prize next year. And that will give him a powerful incentive over the course of the next 12 months to go to enormous lengths to be a peacemaker, both with regard to Iran and with regard to Gaza. You know, those comments that you played of him talking about Iran, he was actually talking in a very moderate way, as if he were interested in reaching some sort of agreement with the Iranians, much like he's pushing forward this peace proposal or ceasefire in Gaza. But the other point I wanted to make to you, Danny, is I think what's happening in Trump's case is that his base has turned on the Israelis in very important ways. Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson are two really key players in this regard. And Charlie Kirk, of course, was moving in that direction. And I think Trump is feeling the heat from below, from his base, from the body politic more generally in the United States. I mean, he reads public opinion polls. And furthermore, I find it hard to believe that he's not getting a lot of pressure from around the world, that leaders around the world are not telling him that this just has to stop, because the concern with ending this genocide is just so widespread and so deep all around the world. I believe it just has to percolate into the White House, and it has to have an effect on Trump. So I think this is really sort of what's causing him to push hard now to get some sort of ceasefire.
Well, listen, I like your idea about don't give him the peace prize tomorrow, but wait till another year. Maybe we can toss in ending the Russia-Ukraine war into that too, and then I'd build a public campaign for him to win it if he did all of that and kept us out of these other wars. But I guess, like always, we'll have to wait and see what happens, and can't underestimate people making dumb decisions. But we'll just be that bad as it may. But listen, thank you so much for coming on. We covered a whole lot today. Want to send people, if you don't get enough of John on our show, go back to mearsheimer.substack.com to see John's Substack, where he has all kinds of stuff. And you can keep up to date where he puts all kinds of stuff on there, and interviews and videos as well. So thank you very much for coming on, John. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure as always, Danny.
And we will see you guys next on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Thank you very much. See you later.